I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Joining us today is Jenna Heath, one of the Associate Deans of St. Edward's University School of Arts and Humanities. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
Now, October is Arts and Humanities Month, which I quite frankly, I didn't know was a thing until I looked at a calendar that had all of that stuff on there. And Arts and Humanities seems like a very broad spectrum term. What exactly are we referring to?
Well, I think it is broad. I guess I could start by giving you a dictionary definition. I'll do that, and then I'll tell you what the Arts and Humanities are in my working life. So the dictionary defines them as branches of knowledge that concern themselves with human beings and their culture, or with analytic and critical methods of inquiry derived from an appreciation of human values and of the unique ability of the human spirit to express itself. And I think that's a pretty good, if wordy, definition. I think we know what the arts are, poetry, painting, music, writing in different forms, dance, performing arts. The humanities are, a variety of subject areas that kind of encompass human expression and inquiry. So here in the School of Arts and Humanities at St. Edward's, we have a Department of Communication, and we teach classes in relational communication, family communication, standard ways people tend to think about communication, public relations and marketing. We teach languages, literatures, and cultures, Spanish, French, and different ways that language and culture sort of permeate one another and are so obviously, diverse and vital in our lives. We have a Department of Literature, Writing, and Rhetoric. That's my academic department. I teach journalism and digital media. And we teach literature, we teach poetry, we teach screenwriting, creative writing, we teach journalism. We have a Department of Performing Arts and also a theater, the Mary Moody Northern Theater, which is an opportunity for our performing arts students to perform with professional actors because we have a contract with Actors Equity. And that's very unusual for an undergraduate theater. So our students perform and people from the community come to the Mary Moody Northern Theater. And we're actually in the middle of our season right now. And selling season subscriptions and tickets to our next production, so called Shining Lives. So you can find out about that if you like theater. We have colleagues in our school who teach philosophy, who teach religious and theological studies. We have colleagues who teach a wide range in the visual arts, visual studies. So we have art. We have a suite of digital programs. We have a major in video game development, animation. We have a new major launching in digital storytelling and content creation. We have a major in user design, which is a sort of web and app design. So these are all fields in arts and humanities. And as you say, it's broad, and that sort of gives you an idea of the breadth of the arts and humanities.
Well, it seems like it is abstract thought and creativity based more than anything else for, if I had to elevator pitch it for the three floors of our building, that would be the best summary I could come up with, perhaps. I certainly don't mean to sum up your work in three or four words, but
No, that's fine. I think that's true. I'm not sure. I think it's always abstract because, for instance, in digital storytelling and content creation, we teach data storytelling. And you might think, oh, what does data have to do with the arts and humanities? But I think sometimes these lines among disciplines are really very artificial because artists and writers and, you know, deal with numbers. And people over in the natural sciences who are scientists and math people, they read and write. So there's a fluidity, I think, that sometimes when you're talking about academic structures can be that point can be lost. But yes, I think we have a lot to do with creativity, self-expression, but also an understanding. We teach art history, you know, that there's a history and there's a depth of knowledge in these areas that we teach our students and want them to understand the context that their own creativity and self-expression is part of.
Jenna Heath, one of the associate deans at the Arts and Humanities School at St. Edward's University, is joining us. I have a friend who is a pianist, and when we first became friends, I am not a musician, don't play any instruments, have very little grasp of the concept of playing one, and he was telling me how much math is involved with being a pianist specifically, but just music in general, how much math is involved in that. And I was fascinated by that. I'd never thought of it before. Even, hearing time signatures and stuff like that, I never quite frankly thought of it in a way that that's math.
Yes, in a very basic way, you're counting. I mean, rhythm and beats and you're counting. And so I think one thing that parents of young children know, for instance, is that when their kids study music, it helps reinforce their math skills. So yeah, I think what we understand in the arts and humanities is that all of these things are embroidered, and you don't have to be, I often tell my students, you don't have to be a this person or a that person, and you probably aren't, because sometimes I think by the time we're 17 or 18 years old, we've already typecast ourselves in our own minds. I'm not a math person. I am a reading person. I'm not a reading person. I am a math person. Well, I think we're in a world where increasingly, to be really well prepared for the workforce and also just to function, at a high level, maybe you're a little bit of both. Maybe there are more of these lines converge more than we sometimes want to think.
Big old Venn diagram.
Exactly. And I think in arts and humanities, we really do, we think this way.
Well, I think that a lot of people who are outside of the artistic world think that you are either a painter or you are either a musician or you are either a sculptor, and don't really understand that even you're going back to the absolute classics of classics artists, Michelangelo and things like that, they were not one discipline. And it's weird to think nowadays, exactly as you brought up earlier, we have a need to stick things in categories and even categorize ourselves. And I think that it's amazing to find out Tony Bennett can paint.
Yeah,
and those sorts of things, and it's not just paint and put it up on a friend's wall. It's paint and fetch thousands of dollars because it's actually an amazing painting.
Right. I mean, read anything about Leonardo da Vinci. Look at the inventions. I was really fortunate to teach a study abroad with a colleague this summer. And we were in France, and my family came over toward the end, and we went to Amboise, which is the city where Da Vinci died. And we were able to look where he lived and to see his office, his workplace. And, just looking around there and seeing this incredibly voracious and brilliant mind who invented things. And they had this wonderful exhibition that showed sort of models of his inventions. And they also had video that showed what would happen if, because many of inventions he didn't make, but what if they had been actually produced? I mean, there's a plane, there's a flying machine. There's a helicopter. This is a person who's an artist, who is an engineer, who's a draftsman. And, I understand that we're in a time particularly now when there are discussions about higher education that tend to be relentlessly about cost and about sort of the negative, the concerns that people have, because we're living in a tough and challenging time in many, many ways. And I think one of the reasons these lines get overdrawn, these separation ideas, that there's one discipline to go into that will get your kid a job and it's in the hard sciences only, or, you know, I think that that is coming out of a kind of anxiety around the economy and preparing our children and higher education. But really what we all are is a blend of so many kinds of talents and ways of thinking and ways of questioning the world and what we try to do here in arts and humanities. And I think at St. Edward's generally is honor that. And it just makes for a more interesting life. And actually, I think it can make for great professional success. So
I think absolutely. The more things that you are well-versed in, you don't necessarily even have to be great or good at them. It's, you know, it's like the painter who decides to do it just for himself or something like that. It doesn't have to be for any kind of mass appeal or for any kind of monetary thing, but to be able to have an outlet, a creative outlet is important. And I think that maybe that is the gist of our conversation is that, you know, having the ability to have the emotions, good, bad, or indifferent, that are inside you, and having an outlet for them in a creative manner is it's therapeutic.
It is. And it can be very helpful in the workplace. You know, our new program in digital storytelling and content creation, you know, there are, I talk to so many friends in different professions, and so many of them need the stories of their company or their nonprofit or their major project or their new production told really well in the digital space, you know, beautifully on social media or some kind of beautiful interactive online. And the fact is that there aren't a lot of people who know how to do that very, very well. And so we're going to teach that, you know, and this is not only a creative and interesting thing to do, way to tell stories, but it's also and sort of fulfilling as a form of self-expression, but it's also in demand. And so I think people can have creative lives that honor expression, and also have successful professional lives that honor expression. I don't think these two things have to be separated. And so I think if there's anything about the arts and humanities, it's a sort of theme or a leitmotif. It's this idea of collaboration, of overlap, of embroidering in these different areas. And to me, it's a satisfying way to be in the world.
Working in radio, and I've been doing this for quite some time now. So, you know, I've done it in many, many, many different capacities, whether it is in a creative way or whether it is in a supportive way, sitting behind a computer, editing sound, whatever the case may be. There is still something always creative about it, even if it isn't necessarily your creativity. There is something, and being surrounded by that, no matter how chaotic this workplace may be, there is something satisfying about being a part of that. And what got me into radio was actually storytelling. I actually had stumbled upon a couple of great, not only DJs, but talk radio in general that wasn't based in politics. It was based in storytelling. It was based on experiences and things like that. And this was a long time ago, 20-something years ago. And the idea of a voice telling a story, you know, kind of in the middle of the night to the listeners out there, and being able to paint a picture and being able to express what you think and feel and what you see with only your words. We are talking to Jenna Heath, who is one of the associate deans of the School of Arts and Humanities at St. Edward's University. So I have to tell you, it's been a lot of pressure doing this interview with you, since you are an expert in everything that I just said.
Well, I don't know if I'm an expert in everything you just said, but I'm certainly an expert in appreciating everything you just said. I think that's a great example. We have a podcasting class here. We're very fortunate to have Matt Largy from KUT, who teaches podcasting here. And we have a podcasting studio in our digital media center, which is in our Monday library. And, you know, the students really love this class. I just get consistently great feedback about it. And the boom in podcasting and in radio over the past few years is just testament to what you're saying. Storytelling is part of what connects us. It's hugely important to the human experience and sharing our stories. And there are hard skills that go with that. You know, where you record. When I tell my students when I'm teaching them audio, you know, I say, now don't go to Joe's, which we have a Joe's coffee shop on campus, and record your interview there. Why? And they have to think for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll sit there and they'll think, oh, yeah, wait a minute. The espresso machine's going to go off and somebody's going to drop a fork. You know, and so teaching them about kind of where to record and how to think about ambient noise, if they want it or they don't want it. And then there are the hard skills around editing that interview. And so it's, these things are combined, both the storytelling and the thinking about what you want the story to be and the actually, you know, the actual, as you know, producing it. And so this is all, you know, really fun and interesting to do and very, I think much, it can really lead to very satisfying professional opportunities as well, because of course we want our students to graduate and get jobs and go off and have fulfilling careers if that's what they want to do, or go to great graduate programs and continue to deepen their skills. But I think that this is all the arts and humanities, and it's everywhere. You know, it just permeates our lives. So I think that the more that we can help young people sort of appreciate the history, their forebears in the fields that they're choosing to study, the context of these fields, where they fit in, how they can do things differently, depart from whatever quote unquote the canon has been, add to it, change it. It's all part of the arts and humanities.
Well, I have to say also, it has been a lot more pressure for me because I did not go to school for any of it.
Well, that makes you even more a creature of the arts and humanities. What did you go to school for?
I graduated from high school in a small little town. The high school was, you know, didn't have a lot to offer. And so when I got out of high school, going to college wasn't the right option for me immediately. I thought I would go to college eventually, but I ended up befriending somebody who worked in radio. And the next thing I know, I'm a talk show host.
Well, that's great.
So yeah, I literally stumbled backwards. But I did it by stumbling backwards into a career. I watched, you know, WKRP in Cincinnati and you know, news radio and stuff like that, and thought, oh, it'd be fun to work in radio, but never really thought of it in any kind of way. And I struck up a conversation with a guy who was a program director of a radio station in Denver. And I said to him, I have a show idea for you. Little did I know that this poor man heard that every day of his life from some fan, somebody on the street, is whoever found out that this guy worked in radio. Mason, I've got a great idea for you for a radio show. It's, how about we cook on the radio or something like that? And they were never good ideas. But one day I said to him, you know, Mason, I have a good idea for a radio show. And the idea was to get a celebrity, and I used the example of an athlete at the time who played football. Is you talk to him about everything but football. We all know what he's accomplished and what he can do and all of that stuff. I want to know, flipping through the channels in the middle of the night, what's the movie that makes you stay up? I want to know, you know, if I opened up your CD player right now, what CD is in there? Like, those are the questions I want to ask people. And he's like, I actually like that idea. And kidding around, I say, so when do I start? He goes, how about Saturday? And 2 weeks later, I'm standing in a radio studio. Hi, my name is Brian.
I think that's awesome. I think that's so great because you found your way to the thing that you really love and turned out to be good at. I mean, I think that I was an English major. I almost had a double major in history. I loved reading and writing. For a long time, I thought I was going to be a lawyer, and then I thought, no, I'm going to go off and get a doctorate in English literature. But I had been a high school journalist, and I had loved journalism. I had been the managing editor of my high school paper. It had really grabbed me early, and I kind of took a road away from it, but I wound up back at it. And so I think sometimes there's this big discussion around, do you tell young people to follow their passion or not? And there are the follow your passion people, and there are the no, do not follow your passion. Your passion will lead you to unemployment. You must do this or that. That will, you know, check the Bureau of Labor Statistics and see who's hiring and do that. Well, I don't know. I think that it's somewhere in the middle here. I don't think that you should completely, you can't discount that inner voice. It may actually be leading you. And maybe it's not a straight, direct line immediately, but it may lead you to the thing that is really going to be successful for you. And, you know, when you think about what work is for most of us, work is not an option. We're going to work for the many, many decades of our adult lives. It is going to be the most consistent thing in our lives. And, you know, I always think you better, if you can, if it's possible to really like your work and to get a deep sense of satisfaction from it, not every day or every week, but fundamentally, most of the time, you're going to have a more successful life. So, you know, however you get there, you get there. And this is something that I tell my students, because they get very anxious as they're approaching graduation, as you can imagine. And they want to know, like, what's the line? How did you do it? What was your path? And I tell them pretty early on, you know, my path was a little circuitous. I didn't actually go into journalism as a professional until I was in my late 20s. I worked for a publishing house for a year. I worked for a law firm writing their newsletter for a year. I was kind of circling around it. I knew I was a reading writing person, but somehow I wasn't claiming journalism. And when I finally did, I said to myself, this is really what I want to do. Well, the line got straighter. And then, you know, for 20 years, I was a working journalist and editor. And then in my second career, it's as an extension of my first career. I teach journalism and digital media. I teach digital storytelling, because during the time that I was in the newsroom, very quickly when I entered newsrooms, the world became digital. And so, you know, what are you going to do? Sit there and go, no, I don't know how to do this, and be angry at the gods? Or are you going to learn how to do new things that you didn't know how to do before? So I think there's also a flexibility and a habit of mind and an openness. So I'm going to learn something new. I'm going to try something new. I'm going to listen to my gut a little bit. I'm not saying that you discount practical considerations. I had to pay my rent. I had student loans. But I don't think these are either or things. And I think that the arts and humanities are just the opposite of either or. I guess if I had to do your pitch, your third floor pitch that you were mentioning at the beginning.
I think that's actually very, very well said, in the sense that you can even find satisfaction in your work, even if it is not in the field that you want to stay in. So there is a lot to that just being an attitude thing. But as far as, like you were saying, is making the digital jump, I have worked in radio for over 25 years, and I have three different times in the very, very early aughts, we made the jump from tape and analog to digital. It happened in three straight jobs that I had. And there were people who refused to learn. There were people who, I have always, you know, where are my razor blades? I'm supposed to cut this tape. Well, you're not. You're using a mouse today, sir. And, you know, we offered you classes on this. We offered you the opportunity to learn this. And, you know, it ended up costing some people their jobs that had been there for quite some time, because the only other option was to hire somebody else to help them. Well, what would be the point of that? Just hire someone to replace them. And that unfortunately ends up being, if you have a lockstep way of thinking, if you are, you know, inflexible to a fault, it will get the best of you. And I'm not, you know, saying believe in karma or that the universe has a plan for you, but your surroundings and your life will let you know if you're in the right place or not.
I think that's true. And I also think what you describe, I saw that in newsrooms as well. And I even see it, frankly, in higher ed to some degree. And I think a lot of that is fear. I think it's scary when you're trained a certain way, you have a certain understanding of the way things are done. You've built up a certain sense of expertise, and suddenly it's changing. That's scary. And I can see that there's there's a way of sort of getting into a defensive crouch about it. But what I try to say to my students is, you know, try to stay open to what you don't know. Don't feel like you have to be an expert at everything. Look at me. I'm 60 years old, and I'm teaching you how to do these things that you don't know how to do with digital technology, because I learned it along the way. And I don't know a lot of things that you can teach me. And so I think sometimes it's just helping to remind myself and to remind my students to be in the world in a way that where we don't put pressure on ourselves to know things we don't know. And I think when you're in a work environment and you're under pressure professionally, it can be really hard to be in that frame of mind, you know, and you can develop resentment about things changing. But, you know, resentment will just hold you back. And it's the world is changing very quickly. Technology is an enormous part of our lives. And I think my personal view of it is, better to try to learn about it, understand it, contemplate it, evaluate it, assess it, use it, than to try to fight it off, because I think that's futile. And, you know, there are other things we do here in arts and humanities. For instance, we've launched some credit bearing certificates, and one of them is in advanced Spanish for the health and helping professions. Because we're launching kind of a nursing program and in the other schools, but the advanced Spanish for the health and helping professions is based here in the School of Arts and Humanities. So we are collaborating with our colleagues in the sciences, in the natural sciences, in other areas, in other schools at our university, because we recognize that, hey, we have skills over here that they can use, and vice versa. So we try to, I think, increasingly work together in that way to give students all the opportunities that we can give them, regardless of our disciplinary fields of expertise. We try to think how they can work together.
Jenna Heath is one of the associate deans of the School of Arts and Humanities at St. Edward's University, and she is joining us here on Inside Austin. Well, I want to really quickly touch on two things that you were, touch on two things that you had said in the beginning of what you were talking about there. And that's, I think the people you had said that fear led them to not learn new skills. I think that sometimes that is also a reflection on the teacher or the person trying to train. In a work environment where someone is now, you know, training somebody else to learn a new skill, there is some inherent unwillingness sometimes on someone who is doing the training to not train that person to their fullest capability because fear of losing their job or something silly like that. They might be better at it, whatever insecurities there are. And I think that you have, and this is the other thing I wanted to bring up, and is I think you have proven in this conversation that you're a good teacher based on the fact that you recognize that failing is a part of learning.
Well, I hope I'm a good teacher. My father's still living. My mother passed away, but they were both really wonderful teachers. My mother was a Latin teacher. My father is an artist, and he was an art teacher. And so I really lived with two people who lived and breathed teaching when I was growing up. And so I hope I got something from them. But I do think in my own experience, look, when the newsroom was changing and digital technology was really taking over, you know, I had graduated from Columbia from the journalism school there. I had this fancy journalism degree, and I was a print journalist, trained as a print journalist, and I had worked at my first newspaper. It was great. It was an afternoon paper in Alabama. And then suddenly I go to the Charlotte Observer, and it's like, wait a minute, we have to put things online. We haven't even fully reported the story yet. And we'd be like, well, let's just, you know, let's think about getting things up online as quickly as we can. You know, the world was changing. And I'm not suggesting that I wasn't afraid. I was. And when I started teaching, you know, and recognizing how much I was going to have to learn about digital and sort of realize I'm not going to be great at every digital skill. I'm not, you know, I'm an okay video editor. I can teach it to a point, but I know when to get resources in and experts in to help me. I'm a decent audio editor. I mean, I don't expect myself to be able to master every skill, but I do expect myself to understand what students need and to be able to teach them enough to get them started, and then to be open enough about what I don't know to ask people who know more. For instance, Matt Largy, you know, and Josh Hinkle from KXAN teaches broadcast journalism for us. We've been very lucky to ask these two folks to come in, and we often bring professionals in when we can to teach, because I know what my limits are. You know, Josh is going to teach students to put together a much better broadcast package than I ever could. And Matt is going to teach them about radio and podcasting with much more depth than I can. But what I can do is really be open to understanding what students need and not be afraid of what I don't know. But I got there through fear. Fear was really locking me down. And I had to battle through that a little bit. I had to take that on personally, you know. And I guess I think that it is an important, you know, to your point, it's an important part of teaching. And I think my colleagues here are just fantastic teachers. I mean, we're a very student-centric private liberal arts university. Students have a lot of contact with us. We work directly with them. Our class sizes are quite reasonable, and teaching is primary for us. So we all, I think, try to teach our students not to collapse with failure, that failure is an opportunity to do the thing better. For instance, in our writing and rhetoric major, I'm in the Department of Literature, Writing and Rhetoric, we teach revision. You know, your first draft isn't going to be your final product, because you're working, it's a process you're working toward through the process of revision. That's not failure. That's actually acknowledging that this is a project or a piece that's evolving. And I think, you know, anybody in almost any field will tell you that why do scientists do experiments? You know, if they don't all prove the hypothesis. And part of what you learn is when the hypothesis is not proved. If you regarded that as a failure, you probably wouldn't do another experiment. You wouldn't form another hypothesis.
Oh, can't be done, and you'd walk away.
Right. I'm done. So, you know, we're always failing. And it took a while, you know, but I've become okay with that in my own life. And I try to help my students be okay with it, too.
I was given some very poor advice when it came to revisions, I think, and that was write drunk and edit sober.
Wow. Well, I don't recommend writing drunk, but hey, you know, who am I to? I certainly would not recommend it for my students. I think it's better to be clear-headed. I think there's a sort of romanticism about the drunken artist, and in my own life, I have found that I do better work if I've had enough sleep. I remember my mentor in graduate school at Columbia was this very, you know, kind of, he was sort of this famous professor at Columbia. His name is Mel Mencher, and he's remained a very good friend, and he was very, very demanding, very much like, you know, whoever that guy was in that TV show, Professor Kingsfield or whatever. He was just, you know, you never quite felt you could meet his standards, and he intimidated students. However, I remember early in the semester, my first semester at Columbia, he made us meet him, and he took us on a walking tour of Harlem. And we went to lunch at Sylvia's, this very famous, wonderful restaurant. And at the end of the walk, he said, "Now, you all think it's, you know, what journalists do is get drunk and stay out all night. But what you have to do is take care of yourself physically. Eat your leafy green vegetables. And, you know, read journalism, but read things that aren't journalism too. And I have two extra tickets to the symphony. Does anyone want to go with me?" and he really, he was telling us something about not just doing journalism, but also about taking care of ourselves in a way where we can think and function. And so I think that's important. But I know that there's a history and a tradition of people writing drunk and editing sober.
Are you familiar with, I had Peter Bay, the conductor of the Austin Symphony, on, and he was talking about the BATS program that they have, which is called Be at the Symphony. And it got started by somebody who worked at, I think he said Texas Instruments, you know, years ago, 80s, whatever it was, 90s. And he was a huge fan of orchestral music, and he noticed that there weren't very many people in the stands. And so he started a program where he would buy a ticket for the people that he worked with and take them to the symphony. And it turned it turned into an actual program now where, you know, they people go to the symphony that ordinarily wouldn't have the chance to. And, you know, it's that thing that you've been talking about that's probably the theme of the entire conversation we've had, which is that, you know, the overlapping is the important part. You don't want to be an expert on one thing. You want to be knowledgeable about a lot.
Yeah, and you can be an expert on one thing and love other things. You can be, in other words, we are in such a difficult time. I know, you know, because of my work with teaching journalism and digital media and all the years I've worked full time as a journalist, you know, we're in this time of fragmented media. We're in this time of polarization. We're approaching an election now. And, you know, this discussion around whether the voter turnout's going to be anything like it really we would hope it would be. And it's a time, I think, when people can feel very separate from one another, when there can be a lot of antagonism and an emphasis around differences. And what I would say is that when you buy a ticket for someone to go to the symphony who's never been there, may think, oh, I don't have any interest in this, or the symphony hasn't always been a place that has welcomed people from diverse backgrounds or made it possible for people to go. And that's a big discussion in the arts now, as you know, around theater and around classical music and much more opening up and discussion of this. But when you buy someone a ticket and you bring them there, this is humanity. This connects us. Reminds us that we're all on this little spinning marble together, and we're connected to one another, and there's beauty out there, and people are making beautiful things. I mean, really, you don't have to be an expert to appreciate any of that, and it should be part of how we all live, and in my opinion, and I think that's also a big theme for us in the arts and humanities. You know, have some beauty in life and share it. And don't get yourself hung up about whether you're expert at it. You know, just go out there and appreciate it and experience it.
Find some beauty and go out there and share it. I don't know if I could end this on a better note than that.
Well, I've enjoyed talking with you. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me.
Oh, the pleasure has been absolutely mine, and I no longer feel the pressure that I did at the start of this, feeling like I was talking to somebody who knew my field better than I did.
Oh, I'm absolutely certain I don't know your field better than you do, so we'll have to talk more so I can learn more.
We are talking to Jenna Heath, one of the Associate Deans of Arts and Humanities at St. Edward's University. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly Auto Parts.